Okay, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And now, great pleasure and honor for me to introduce to you Herbert van de Sompel. Maybe it's not really necessary to introduce him, but just a few words on the impressive CV that he has. He started in Ghent in Belgium and had a degree in computer science there and also obtained a PhD there. Then he was a visiting professor in computer science at Cornell University, director of e-strategy and programs at the British Library, and then team leader of the Digital Library Research and Prototyping team at the Research Library of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And he has many, many technical achievements, among them OAI-PMH, SFX, OpenURL, and recently OAI-ORE. And how do you pronounce it? ORE. And a large project on metrics called Mesure that we will hear a lot of, I think, this year. But yeah, let him speak for himself. So, Herbert van de Sompel, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you so much, Wolfram, for your introduction. And thanks a lot for the organizers to invite me. It's actually sincerely a real pleasure to be here. This is a very special occasion for me for various reasons. First of all, I actually grew up in a town not too far from here. It's a little town, or it used to be a little town of Arnsberg, and that's only about an hour's drive from here. So obviously, this area brings back memories, and tomorrow I will go back and visit and see what has become of that place. And so here I am in Arnsberg, in front of the fireplace in our house, basically swearing on my scout's honor that I was going to try and do something useful with my life. The other thing, the second reason this is special for me is that right now it's 10 years ago that I left Belgium and, you know, started to, you know, work abroad to indeed try and do something interesting with my life. And so before that, for 17 years, as Wolfram indicated, I had been in charge of library automation at Ghent University. As a matter of fact, I started it from scratch. When I arrived there, there was nothing. And so when I left, we had achieved quite, you know, an interesting level of automation. We did quite some pioneering work. We were very early to install local area networks, for example, in libraries. The technicality of that is not interesting, but more the philosophy that it would allow people to share information on a network. We were very early on with CD-ROM networks, both in local area network and wide area networks. And we did quite some leadership work, actually, in the realm of a union catalog of Belgium on CD-ROM. And these last three things I mentioned because in those days, we used to have quite some contact with the Bielefeld Library, where they were working in a pioneering role on exactly these same kind of issues. And those were the days that Dr. Neubauer was still here. Then we did Silverplatter-ERL. We were the first in the world to adopt ALA 500, so help us God. We were very early on with doing, actually the first in the world, to define an SGML format for MARC records. For those that remember, SGML is the thing that came before XML. Anyhow, all of that to say that we did a lot of pioneering work that looks technical at first glance, but all of it had this notion of improving access to information. With that came a notion of equity of access to information, equal access to information for everyone, hence later on the whole notion of open access that I got involved in. And gradually, by working in library automation, I started to understand, and it took me actually, you know, probably more than 10 years to understand that we were not just about delivering those books or those journals to our researchers and our students, but that we played a fundamental role in the scholarly communication system. And it was indeed providing access, but it was a crucial role in that system. And it made me think about, well, if providing access is the role that we've played in the paper-based system, because someone had to do it, someone had to store physically the information and provide access to, what is the role of the libraries going to be in the new generation, the digital kind of era? And this is really how I got involved in a lot of the efforts that I'm going to talk about today. The third reason this is a very special occasion for me is that after having worked for 10 years on a variety of projects that you see here, some of which I will actually discuss in some detail, I'm going to go back to Los Alamos and I'm going to have a 6-month sabbatical. And you are not. So anyhow, because all these kind of special reasons that, you know, collide in this presentation, I thought I was going to do something of a special presentation also. And this is not going to be one of the typical Herbert presentations where I stand here and I tell you what the problem is. And by the way, I also have the solution. This is going to be an overview of problems that I have been involved in solving, or at least trying to solve. And so basically, you will be able to judge on my behalf whether, first of all, those were worthwhile problems to work on, and two, whether we actually did a good job at trying to solve them. And so by now, you must have been able to have a look at some of the things that I'll talk about. The arrows that you see actually mean that all these projects kind of somehow are interrelated, and it goes to show how you build on your own legacy. You know, when you start with a few concepts, you take it from there, and 10 years later you look back and you say, gee, I've done most of the same kind of stuff for 10 years. Anyhow, I'll talk about SFX, OpenURL, PMH, BX, ORE, and Measure, and I'm sure I won't have the time to do all of that, so probably I'll skip some. So but let's start with SFX. SFX was a project that I actually started when I was still at Ghent University. Those were the early days, this is now 10 years ago, where you remember that, you know, publishers started to, not experiment, but to deploy electronic journals online. One of the very first services they added on top of just providing access to those journals is providing reference links. So they made basically the links in the reference table clickable. And the idea was that if a user would click that link, you would then go to the actual corresponding full text in some other publisher's repository. I mean, that was very noble. That was a great idea. But there was a little problem with it. And the problem was known in the United States at that point as the appropriate copy problem. And the issue was the following. Some of you may remember. When you were, you know, let's say, looking at an Elsevier journal and you were clicking in the reference list to a Wiley journal, Elsevier would send you directly to Wiley, to the appropriate page there. However, since libraries have subscriptions through various intermediaries, there was many cases, actually, it happened that one would click and would get a 404. Sorry, you know, doesn't exist, or you don't have access, or what have you not. And so people basically didn't get access to the information that they had a legal right even to get access to. The problem was very well known in Europe, in the United States. And so the question really was, when you see such a reference link, how do you get not just to the copy of the publisher, but to the appropriate copy, meaning to the copy that an institution has access to? The solutions that at that time were proposed were basically all totally unscalable. And they consisted, the general idea was that every library in the world would send information on all its holdings to every information provider in the world, and by the way, then also keep that stuff updated. There would, of course, be enormous scalability kind of problems with that. And I started working actually on my PhD, because this is what I got my PhD with. And I started to think, well, maybe we can do this in another way. And rather than do this in a static batch kind of a way, you know, and push stuff to the publishers, why don't we push information in the opposite direction? Namely, push metadata about the thing that you want to access to the library, because the library has all that information about its own holdings, and let the library then link out to wherever it is appropriate. So that is, you know, what became known as the OpenURL framework, really. And it consisted, as you see in this slide, by the way, I'll have most of my slides are old ones that I've inserted, and you see the date of the slide underneath there. Okay, this is really a back-in-time kind of presentation, as I'm sure you understand by now. So basically, the solution consisted of, at the end of a publisher or whichever information provider, insert a link. The link points at an institutional linking server, and the link contains information about the thing that you want services for. For example, you want the full text of. So it would contain metadata and identifiers. And then we would have at the institution a linking server that would be powered by a rule set and a knowledge database. It would look at that metadata and identifiers, and it would say, hey, for my users, that stuff is over there. That was the solution. And actually, when I presented it, and I still lively remember, at an ALA meeting in New Orleans, it was as if, you know, a bomb had exploded. People just could just not believe that this problem was potentially solved. But many good ideas are lost, do not get adopted, and takes a lot of effort to go from an initial concept, a proof of concept kind of solution, to something that gets adopted by the community. A big problem that we had in deploying this kind of a concept was reluctance at the end of information providers. And quite understandably so. This is not even meant as a criticism. The mental shift publishers had to make is that they had a user basically caught in their services. And they had to hand over that user to overlay services that they did not understand the nature of. They were not defining the services that an institution was going to provide to its end users. So they had to let go of control, basically. Before, they were controlling that this link would go to Wiley. Now this link would go to a linking server in an institution. They had no clue what was going to happen there. This problem could only be solved by a lot of advocacy, talking with information vendors, etc., etc. This was a scalability problem for us, by which I mean my people at Ghent University, because this is stuff that we could not engage in. Hence, a decision basically to go with a commercial vendor at that point in time, which became Ex Libris, who then did all the advocacy for us. The OpenURL framework, as a matter of fact, became quite successful. We published open specifications that would allow everyone to adopt this open linking framework. We published papers in which even the whole architecture of such a linking server was explained, thus allowing not only Ex Libris, but other companies to create those linking servers. And so today the situation, if I understand correctly, is that there's about 3,000 of those linking servers in operation still worldwide, 1,700 of which are SFX servers. And if, let's just take a very minimal amount of clicks a day towards those linking servers, let's take 1,000 for each of those a day, that amounts to about 3 million OpenURL clicks that are going on a daily basis. The reason I mention that is this is kind of cool. The other is, later on I'll talk about BX, in which the notion of having a lot of clicks is very important. So this one, the SFX kind of effort, I personally would give a big thumbs up. And actually, you can vote. Next one, I'll talk about this OpenURL, directly related. When we deployed the linking server solution, we put out a specification. It was a very, very simple specification that would basically indicate how a publisher was going to put metadata and identifiers on an HTTP URI, you know, so that all publishers around the world, et cetera, would do it exactly the same way. And so all linking servers would understand, you know, what is coming in. That's what we call information interoperability. Because the whole solution was rapidly actually being adopted worldwide, NISO came forward, which is the American Information Standardization Organization, and they said, this thing needs to be standardized. You cannot just have a little spec out there on the web. We need a formal standard for this. And so obviously what we could have done is say, well, here's the little spec, the one pager. We're now just going to officially give this a stamp, and that's a standard. Unfortunately, maybe I should say, we got a little bit ambitious. And rather than sticking to the very focused kind of problem of just the linking server environment, we started thinking, and I blame myself as a matter of fact for this, about big time generalizations of that framework. In essence, the idea was, well, if you can do such a thing for journal articles, right, basically have a description of a journal article, put it on that description on an interoperable link to a linking server, and that one is then going to give you services. Well, if we can do it for journal articles, we can do it for everything, right? We can do it for CD-ROMs, for music. We can do it for pizza, for houses, for cars. We can basically, for everything that can be described, we could employ this framework. That was one level of generalization. The other was that there is more that can be said when you transport information for a service request. You can, of course, and that's what the original OpenURL did, describe your object that you're going to request services about, but you can add a lot of extra information, a lot of context is how we called it. You can talk about who made that request. Why did you make that request? Where were you when you did that request, et cetera, et cetera. All kind of extra information that one could employ in a similar kind of framework. Now, this is a really cool slide, I think. This is May 2001, and so we had been talking about generalization, et cetera, and already here the signs were on the wall. Look at the second part here. You know, up there are the pros of generalization. You know, basically we can apply it to everything in the world. But the negatives were already there. Generalizations rarely are simplifications. And then the last one, increasing complexity may result in stagnating buy-in. Well, I guess that's indeed what happened. We released, well, first of all, the OpenURL standard, the NISO standard, took 3 years of work of lots of people, cost me most of my gray hair, has been out there now for a couple of years, and what we've seen is that the main adoption of the standard is still in the linking server area. Hardly any applications beyond, you know, the original linking server SFX and what have you not have adopted this specification, which when you look at it from, you know, a return on of investment ratio, it actually doesn't look all that great. I still think that it is a very interesting and very powerful standard. But there's a few things wrong with it. The generality, it's extremely abstract. The vocabulary, you've seen those terms here, referent, referring entity, et cetera, is kind of prohibiting. It's very hard to read the stuff. Then we have the syntax specification that is also hard. And then lastly, and I think this is an important one and goes back to something that Lee Dirks alluded to, this is an ISO standard. And I don't want to criticize NISO necessarily, but it is a standard that comes out of our community. It's a formal standard. But somehow, our community seems to have problems to get our stuff adopted beyond our own realm. Not necessarily because we only think in our own realm. I think I've shown you that we thought actually quite broadly. But we just do not seem to have the tentacles to reach into those other kind of areas where stuff like this could also be adopted. I'm going to cut this short, but I'm going to just want to give you one example of where the standard could still today actually prove to be very useful. And it's out there in Web 2.0 space. I'm sure you've seen with the increasing amount of capabilities to mash up information, as we call it in Web 2.0, you see an increasing amount of those URIs, you know, HTTP, etc., etc., and then they have a parameter on them, and that parameter is URI itself. Okay, so there's basically two URIs. You see them when you're in a blog environment, right? And it has this little icon, share in Delicious or so. Look at that URI. It's pointing at Delicious, and it carries a URI as a parameter, namely the URI of the blog entry. Okay, this is a typical open URL kind of thing, because we are making a service request pertaining to a thing identified by a URI. Why could OpenURL be interesting here? Well, again, look at all those URIs, because there's not only Delicious, there's like hundreds of these environments in which you can push your thing. All these URIs have a different syntax. For each of those environments, you need to use a different syntax to push an entry across the board. With OpenURL, you could have one. The situation is so bad, I dare say, that a commercial company emerged called ShareThis, and they are basically kind of a middleman that translates all these incoming syntaxes to all outgoing syntaxes. So we could get rid of that company if we would all use OpenURL there. All right, from here to the protocol for metadata harvesting. Now, that, as a matter of fact, that is a very interesting story, I think, myself. So obviously, the protocol for metadata harvesting itself was something about improving access to scholarly information. So it clearly fits in that technical kind of realm. But the thinking, the philosophy that we were using at those moments in time were all about fundamentally transforming scholarly communication. And so I was personally really surprised when I saw these slides back, and they are December 99. I'm sure I had used them before. But here were the days where I traveled the world, and I would talk to audiences like you, and I would basically say, people, our scholarly communication system, and especially the journal system, is totally screwed up. It does not work, okay? And then I used the Rosendahl and Gertz framework, you know, about the different functions of scholarly communication to explain why it was completely screwed up. And obviously, there was this whole notion of the serial crisis, which we are still dealing with today, that prevented accessibility of information. But more was wrong with the system, is what, you know, I suggested to audiences. For example, in the journal system, the registration of a new finding by submitting a manuscript and the certification of it through peer review is kind of glued together. And since the peer review system is relatively screwed up, as a lot will agree with me, that means a lot of novel ideas actually never see the light of day. Okay. Then there was a whole notion of the rewarding function, that basically the rewarding function means how do researchers get promotion and tenure based on their publication record. And as we all know, a lot of it involves the ISI impact factor, which I then told audiences, well, that is a stabilizer for the journal system. Because basically, once a journal has an high impact factor, every author wants to publish there, hence it has an high impact factor, right? We never proved this mathematically, but it sounds reasonable to me. So basically, what we're saying here, we have to completely tear this up. And here we went, we said, well, there are people that have thought about this and actually have proposed other solutions to all of that. And maybe we have meanwhile forgotten about this. But in 1993, Smith, I think it's Robert Smith, from the UK, proposed this idea of a deconstructed journal. And basically he said, we need to decouple registration, so basically the manuscript publication, from the certification, from the peer review. And institutions, academic institutions, via their libraries, are going to collect all these unpeer-reviewed materials and make them freely accessible. And then, of course, we had Harnett's subversive proposal that fundamentally is different, really, because Harnett was and is still today talking about the peer-reviewed literature and self-archiving that. In Harnett's worldview in those days, it was about self-archiving them on your home site or on your FTP site, even in those days. But then later on, it was about archiving that in institutional repositories. Why I find this so very fascinating is that already there, in those early days, you saw that conceptual bifurcation of institutional repositories, where on the one hand, there's a movement that is all about collect the peer-reviewed literature and stuff it in there so that it becomes freely accessible. And where another is about get all that other stuff, you know, never mind the peer-reviewed literature, let all that other stuff that people are creating, you know, while they do research, software, data sets, videos, etc., etc. Already in those early days, you could see that. Then in addition to that, we had really implemented models, you know, of course, the Los Alamos archive now at Cornell, which is the physics archive. And in different disciplines, we had actually preprint kind of communication that had been going on for a couple of years. And so basically what we did at those points, it's good to kind of remember that for the record, is we decided really that communication via preprints of uncertified materials, that was going to be the way to go. And that's the way we're going to fundamentally transform the scholarly communication system. And so what you see here is kind of a very, very simple depiction of the model. A is author, R is reader. And basically the idea is the author submits his stuff, you know, through the library in a globally free information layer that's, you know, open for access to everyone. And then all the other functions of scholarly communication, including peer review, right, would, as a matter of fact, occur as an overlay on top of that free layer. And some of these services would be free, and some of these services would be for pay. And the author would then decide whether he was going to, the reader at the right-hand side would then basically decide whether he was going to consume from the free layer or from, you know, the overlay, depending on his needs, his acquaintance with the domain, etc. That's 10 years ago. We were thinking along those lines. And that's where we said, well, okay, this is going to happen, right? We believed our own story. And we said, that means that we're going to see these repositories pop up all over the place. There's going to be thousands of those. Actually, by the way, that happened. And hence, we're going to have a serious interoperability problem. Because, you know, somehow these things will have to talk to each other. That's where we started what initially was named UPS, the Universal Preprint Service, that later on got the name Open Archives Initiative. Okay. And so the first problem that we actually looked at was that problem of making those preprints, because that's really what we were talking about, more easy to discover. And we proposed a metadata harvesting framework, not a federated search, because federated search would never scale across thousands of repositories, but rather a framework that would harvest metadata. And then it took us about 2 years or so to release the first version of a technical interoperability specification that is now known as the Protocol for Metadata Harvesting. So how do you evaluate a thing like that? Well, first of all, there's the philosophy, and then there's the technical protocol that came out of it. When you look at the philosophical aspect of all of this, I mean, it's totally obvious that the systemic change that we were talking about 10 years ago did not happen. We are not communicating via preprints. We're still communicating largely through the journal system. That systemic change, as a matter of fact, may never happen. And maybe we don't even care very much that it will happen. And why do I say that? Well, I was listening, as you were, I'm sure, very carefully to those people in the previous session. And just thinking and sitting there and saying, what do we care about the paper literature? It's all about the data now, right? I mean, we heard from Martin. Basically, it's all about machine representation of knowledge. It's about people are not even able to read that stuff anymore because there's so much out there. Okay, so maybe what we should focus on in this whole open access movement, you know, in the future, is those data sets and make sure that that kind of data does not go down the same path that our literature has gone down. Keep our eyes on that data because probably that's where the real action is in the future. Institutional repositories. What to say about that? Well, first of all, looking back at this discussion, it's clear that there was a reason that we introduced those. They were introduced to transform scholarly communication. Let's please keep that in mind. They are not a means to an end. It's not like you need an institutional repository because you need an institutional repository. You need an institutional repository actually to add something to scholarly communication. Otherwise, it's probably not worth the investment. The focus on what goes in these systems, I think, is different here in Europe, if I may say so, when compared to over in the States. That bifurcation that I talked about earlier on, I think it's reasonable. It's a generalization. But I think it's reasonable to say that in Europe, there's much more focus on the established literature and putting that into the repositories, where I've seen in the States more a tendency towards all that other stuff, make that available so that people can do something with it. There's this whole problem of populating repositories that I keep hearing about, right? There's just no stuff in our institutional repository. Well, maybe that is partly related, I'm saying maybe, this is all speculation, but to that whole notion of focusing on the peer-reviewed literature in some cases. Why is that? Well, listen, if you have published yourself in journals, once your publication is in there and accepted, the job is done. You do not care anymore that that thing is in your repository. What you care about is you have it in an Elsevier journal or in a Springer journal or a Wiley journal. That's what matters for you as a scientist. So the incentive to do that extra kind of effort is kind of not there. So that's one of the problems. The other, and someone mentioned it earlier also, is related to the whole workflow notion. When it was a person from Max Planck. Basically, it was about whatever you do, you know, it has to be basically contained in the existing workflow of a researcher, right? So what we do with institutional repositories and ask them to go to this form and fill out metadata and what have you not, well, that clearly is not part of his workflow, right? So that's kind of understandable. It's not going to happen. But there's a more important aspect to this. It's the following. Those people are creating content all over the place, all over the web. As I indicated earlier, they're out there in publishers' repositories, but they have videos on SciTV, they have presentations in Flickr. They basically are people of this age, and they are generating and depositing content all over the place. So maybe, when thinking about workflow, we should rather start thinking about when they are there in all those other systems where by default they are creating that information and depositing that information. How can we, as a matter of fact, make it easy to push then that stuff from that environment, from YouTube, from Side TV, from, you know, PowerPoint environment SlideShare, to your institutional repository. Remember what I said earlier about share this, you know, how you push stuff across, you know, from one environment to another, and how there's this thing in the middle that kind of, you know, makes sure everything ends up in the right place. Well, maybe that's something that our community should start thinking about. Maybe it's not about asking an author, hey, go to this little DSpace page or Fedora page and upload your PDF. Maybe it's more about, could we get, like with OpenURL, a link out there in all these information services where our researchers are depositing stuff, so that in a seamless kind of way, they can push information across surrogates or the real stuff. There's things to be said about the protocol for metadata harvesting also. Has it been successful? Has it not been successful? As a matter of fact, it's a very difficult call. When you evaluate it in the world as we exist, in which discovery is basically defined really by Google, and whether your stuff is findable in Google or not, well, then clearly the protocol for metadata harvesting did not do a good job. Why? Well, partly because we're dealing with metadata. Metadata as such gets lost in that enormous amount of information, of full content information that Google is indexing. Two, some of the approaches in the protocol for metadata harvesting are somewhere between the REST approach, which is very easy for crawlers to use, and the service-oriented approach, which is not easy for crawlers to use. And so there's some issues there. And lastly, because ranking in engines like Google is to a large extent a function of who is pointing at you, well, no one is pointing at metadata records, right? So those just do not get the page rank and just do not show up. The protocol for metadata harvesting, to say a good thing about it, is still, I think, a very interesting protocol to synchronize between databases. And lots of organizations, as a matter of fact, use it for that purpose. So the original purpose, make things easy, preprints easier to search, we kind of didn't really, you know, deliver on that. But it is a very interesting protocol to exchange massive amounts of XML structured data. Oh my God. I've basically covered three of the six topics I wanted to cover. So what am I going to do here now? Let's have a look. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to let you choose which extra one I'm going to address. So you have a choice between BX, Measure, and ORE. What? All of it. Honestly. You people don't have a life or something? Okay. Two. Wolfram told me two. So since we're talking... I was talking about the protocol for metadata harvesting. So I was talking Open Archives Initiative. Let me talk a little bit here about our new effort, ORE, which stands for Object Reuse and Exchange. Some of the thinking behind ORE goes back to something I talked about earlier, that whole notion of there is some stuff that sits in repositories, and you're going to add value to it. So it's all about scholarly value chains. Have some raw material, have some stuff, some objects here and there, and add value. This is a slide I presented at an Ex Libris meeting in COS, actually. I was not able to explain to my boss why I needed to go to a conference in COS, Greece. Can you imagine? Anyhow, this basically the consideration here was that there was something else that we were doing wrong with repositories. We were using repositories, or we looked at repositories in the sense of you deposit stuff there, and that's the end of their lifetime. It's like you archive it there, and okay, people can come and find it maybe, but we didn't have the notion of, you know, what you really do when you put stuff in a repository is you facilitate reuse, to use a Web 2.0 term, mashups. Let's reuse that stuff, you know, once it's there. Let's put an object in there, let's have someone else come in, add value to it, and push the result into another repository. That is really the philosophical kind of thinking that started the ORE effort. Now, if you're going to do these kind of things, add value to certain objects in a web environment, then you're going to need, from a technical perspective, a handle on those objects, meaning, you know, you need to be able to talk about them. Now, we know how to talk about things on the web. You do it by means of their URIs. That's easy. There's a little issue here, though, and this now relates to the whole e-science discussion from earlier on. The problem is that a lot of the objects that we're starting to deal with in e-science, e-humanities, e-education are aggregates of resources. They are not just one thing. It's not like the paper and it's one PDF. No, no, no. New communication items that you find in repositories are aggregates of a paper, a piece of software, a data set, a visualization, a model, etc., etc. And somehow, that notion of an aggregation had to be inserted into the web architecture because it's not there. And that's really, from a technical perspective, what ORE does. It gives us a way to identify aggregations of resources that exist on the web, and it gives us a way to describe them in a machine-readable way. Okay, so basically, you have a list of URIs saying, hey, I'm part of that aggregation. And then in addition to that, you can express a variety of relationships between all these resources. So the solution is a very simple one. It consists of publishing machine-readable information to the web that basically says, the thing with that URI is an aggregation of other resources. And by the way, the resources that it aggregates are these. Solving that problem doesn't at all yet solve that whole notion of reuse, of value chain, etc., that I talked about in the philosophical aspect of all of this. But without a solution to this problem, we couldn't even start thinking about how to address these value chains. So that's why I think this was kind of a worthwhile effort. There is something that I think is very important about the ORE effort. And it's not necessarily the spec itself. I think the spec is really cool, really good, okay? But there's something else that has been going on during this effort that I think is very important. And again, it relates to something Lee Dirks was talking about earlier. When you look at how in the digital library environment, we have typically looked at information interoperability problems, and that includes the protocol for metadata harvesting, by the way, is as follows. We have said, well, you know, we have a collection of things here, we call that a repository, let's say, and in order to create interoperability between kind of collections, we put a service interface in front of those, like the protocol for metadata harvesting. And if you know about that service front end, then, you know, you can basically play the interoperability game. And if a lot of us do it, then that's even better. So it's a perspective. You can kind of call it an inward kind of perspective. It almost goes back to the library as a building, you know, the repository as, you know, a structure. It's almost the same kind of thing. And you build your services around that. Some really cool things have been achieved from that kind of perspective. But there is a problem with this. And the problem is that it doesn't vibe very well with the way the web works, and with the way general purpose applications on the web work. And the reason is that the web architecture, you know, as defined by the W3C, does not talk about things like repositories or collections. It doesn't even speak about web servers. The only thing it talks about are resources that are identified by means of URIs. And when you dereference the URIs, you get a representation back. That's all. Those are the primitives. The most massive web applications out there are based on those primitives. PMH does not, and other the digital library interoperability protocols do not play that kind of a game. And hence, they require something special to be done, you know, for applications to consume the data. And hence, it didn't come as a surprise at all that at one point Google said, we're not going to support the protocol for metadata harvesting anymore, right? Because it just does not fit in their worldview of crawling URIs. By the way, they never really supported it, okay? So what we did in ORE is we kind of completely inversed the situation. And we looked at that problem of aggregations of resources from the perspective of the web. And we said, how can we define that problem and how can we solve it completely in terms of the primitives of the web architecture? This change in focus, you could really say 180 degrees change in focus on information interoperability, is for me the biggest lesson, and as a matter of fact, the biggest eye-opener of this entire ORE exercise. The way we've specified interoperability in ORE builds on those primitives of the web architecture, URI resource representation, on some notions of the semantic web, and some notions of the linked data kind of world. This is very important from a technical perspective. It's also extremely important from a largely sociological kind of perspective. In that, I think it is essential that we integrate scholarly communication more deeply with the general human debate that is occurring on the web. And we can only achieve that by applying solutions, technical solutions, that are in sync with the web architecture on which all those other applications are built. So ORE, it's way too early to say whether this is going to be successful or not. The specs were just released October last year. I understand there's projects both in Europe and in the United States that are ongoing to test the specs. I'm especially interested in the connection between the ORE work and the SWORD work that you may know of. SWORD, coming out of the UK, is an application profile of the Atom Publishing Protocol. And this is all about interoperable deposit of information in repositories. If we combine ORE with SWORD, we have a first stab at that value chain kind of thing that we envisioned almost 10 years ago. The other thing that is worth mentioning in the realm of getting connected to those other communities is that the W3C, well, especially the semantic web kind of part of the W3C, has taken interest in the ORE specifications, and we are now considering submitting them as a W3C membership submission. I think that would be really interesting, because we would attract more attention from communities beyond our initial scholarly communication environment. Are you sure? Are you still sure? I still need to do another one. Okay, we all want measure, I hear. All right, so that means, with my apologies to the Ex Libris people, I will have to skip BX. And I'll go directly to measure. Measure is a phenomenal project. This is a project that is led by Johan Bollen, a fellow Belgian citizen who works on my team. and in which, obviously, I am also involved. And measure is all about metrics and trying to find new metrics for the assessment of scholarly communication. The ideas, or some of the ideas behind measure, again, go way back. Johan Bollen and I, when we were both at Los Alamos in 1999, we were both working on our PhDs there, already started talking about how usage data collected by linking servers could be like really interesting, on the one hand, for recommendation systems, that's where we have the BX thing, but also for metrics. Because usage data records activities of users. And so there may be patterns there, there may be information there. And so basically this slide again shows you those Rosendahl and Gertz functions of scholarly communication. And you see here usage logs, you know, at the end of a repository where the registration occurs, and then the arrow towards the rewarding function, basically indicating that usage information as recorded by repositories may eventually be used, like the impact factor is today, in promotion and tenure decisions, in decisions to assign grants, etc., etc. This was 10 years ago. Measure is interesting in several ways. First of all, because it considers the following. It says, in the paper-based world, the only metric, the only counting that we could really do in a more or less scalable way was based on citations. Because the citations were in the papers, we could count them, you know, you could create statistics, it was kind of doable. We said, but we are no longer in a paper-based world now. And there's so much more information that is currently being collected. And so we should look at that other kind of information and see whether we can derive metrics from those also. And the data that we got interested in is interaction data. How people are using information systems, publisher systems, linking servers, etc., etc. So that's the one dimension that measure is really interesting in. It kind of expands the notion of a data set that you can use to derive metrics from only citation data to also other data. In our case, usage data recorded by information systems. The other dimension it's really interesting in is that it does not only look at statistical counts. A metric like the impact factor is a pure statistic. It's a count. It's a popularity contest. A lot or not a lot. Okay? What measure does is it generates networks of how information items are connected. And in those networks, it applies concepts from social science and network science to basically compute network metrics. And we don't have time to go into detail about what this all means, but PageRank, that you know from Google, is a typical network metric. And it's a metric that takes into account not only the direct importance of a certain object, you know, direct importance meaning there's a lot of others linking at me. No, it also takes the importance of those linking at you in account and those linking there, etc. It's a recursive algorithm. So basically, it means that all those network metrics, of which PageRank is an example, take the whole context into account. Okay, so they give us other kind of information than the pure statistic. Measure is interesting in another way, in that we basically spent a year collecting data from information providers worldwide. And we basically collected, in English, 1 billion usage events that spreads across about 3 or so years of users clicking things in scholarly information systems. That is a lot of data. Okay, and that is the data set that we have used to basically test the hypothesis. Let's not forget this. Test the hypothesis that indeed valuable information is available in usage data. Before the Measure project, we didn't even know that. I get a little bit frustrated when people approach you or myself and ask, well, did you solve anything with Measure? You know, when is it going to get real? Well, we said, you know what? No one knew that there was any value in usage information before the Measure project started. And now at the end of the Measure project, we can say, as a matter of fact, there is structure there and there is a possibility to derive metrics from there. Okay? So let me show you two really beautiful examples from the Measure project. This here, and I'm sure you will not be able to read this in any detail, but this is a map of science created on the basis of usage data. I guess many of you have seen similar kind of maps that were created on the basis of citation data. What you have going on here is the following. Let me explain. Every little dot here is a journal. Okay? And the connection, when you see a connection between dots, that means that the two journals that are connected have been used in the same information-seeking session a lot and a lot and a lot of times again by many users. So not just one user who said, I'm going from nature to science and from there to a biomedical journal somewhere. No, 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 no. Tens of thousands of users have actually done that and have said, well, here's an article in Nature, here's a reference, I'm clicking through, and I end up in Science. That's what you see here. You don't see all these tiny kind of connections that only happen once. You see connections between journals that result from thousands of times of repeated traversing of that same pattern. And so, again, you cannot see this in any detail, but it's a beauty. Where at the outer circle that you see is really all the sciences and the life sciences. And at the core, in the center, you have the humanities and the social sciences. And then you see, and I guess I need to go here because I can't read it myself. Let me give you a few examples. You basically, I will read you from the right top to somewhere halfway what the disciplines are that we see there. And they will make all sense to you. So we see material science, engineering, thermodynamics, electrochemistry, physical chemistry, organic chemistry, etc., etc. And so it just goes down. And if you would have a detailed look at this entire map, you would see that all these connections, you know, all these neighborhoods and the way they connect really make sense. This is, of course, not a hard scientific way to prove that there is value in usage data, but it kind of intuitively, when you look at it, makes sense that these kind of things would be in joint areas. And then another thing that we did, and this now completely goes back, I think, to this morning's session that was about metrics. Another thing that Johan did in the Measure project is basically for both networks of journal relationships based on usage data, like the one I just showed you, but also for citation networks, so networks of how journals interconnect by means of citation, we computed a whole bunch of possible metrics, some pure statistics, some others network kind of metrics. And then basically, we looked at how these correlated. Okay, are the usage-based metrics correlated in any way? Are the citation-based metrics correlated in any way? And are usage-based metrics and citation-based metrics correlating? The finding is absolutely fascinating. Only two things about it. Again, because we don't have time. But first of all, what you see is, okay, let me explain what you see first. Left top there, those are all the metrics computed on the basis of usage data. And as you see, they cluster very nicely together. That means they're decently correlated. At the right-hand side, you see two clusters of citation-based metrics. One, the upward in the right top corner, they're all metrics that are statistic kind of related. They're pure counting. They're what we call the popularity contest kind of metrics. And down here, you see all the network metrics that are computed on the basis of citation data. The impact factor that we have been using for over 50 years sits up there, you know, site IF. Do you see it? That, you know, the white dot. Something else that is interesting is that the correlation between those clusters, here as follows, the correlation between this entire cluster of usage-based metrics, 0.71 you see there, is higher, that's a correlation with the network-based metrics derived from citation data. Okay, let me try this again. Up there, usage-based metrics. Down here in the middle, citation-based metrics, but network metrics. Correlation, 0.71. Now look at the correlation between network-based metrics derived from citation data and the more statistical kind of metrics derived from citation data, and you have a lower correlation, 0.47, basically indicating that in the landscape that we drew of many possible metrics for scholarly communication items, that you basically see that the one we've been using for 50 years is an absolute outlier. Now, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it means it measures something very, very significant. But you could also say, well, that's kind of bizarre. And this is basically the result, the map, and this is the result of 2 years of research. There's a lot of stuff that will come. The Measure project has officially run out December of last year. But obviously, we're looking for follow-up funding, for example, to look into time variations, you know, the whole analysis over time. So if any of you have money for the Measure project, just let me know. I think this is where I stop. You've been extremely patient with me. I've been talking for more than an hour now. If I may just make very few observations in conclusion. What I've done with you, I've basically looked back at 10 years of projects that I've been involved in, and I've tried to more or less objectively evaluate, you know, what we've achieved there. One of the things that I thought was extremely fascinating when compiling this presentation, by going through all my slides of the past decade, is something about time. It's just amazing how much time all of this takes. Time from an idea to a realization, from a proof of concept to a tool or to a standard, from a tool or a standard to real adoption. I think that is extremely fascinating that even in the era of the World Wide Web and extremely fast communication, all these things seem to take forever. And honestly, I have no explanation for it. Is it just our community? Is it all over the place like that? I don't know. It's very difficult to assess whether something is a success or not. It's easy for a tool, right? A tool, when you put it out there, you can measure its success by means of are people using it immediately or not. It's much harder with the standard. When you put the standard out there, it takes enormous energy to advocate for a standard post the moment that you've released it. And it's very hard to get that kind of advocacy going because by the time you need it, most of the people that were involved in creating the standard are absolutely exhausted. Another thing about time. I was reminded by listening to a speaker this afternoon also. It is like a dead giveaway. It's something we all know, but something that we need to keep in mind as libraries, as we do our thing, whichever way we do it. But the one thing we keep in mind is that the reason we exist, the reason we do our stuff, is to optimize the time researchers have to do their research. Researchers, their scarcest resource is time. So we should all be about optimizing that time. Hence again, that little interface thing where they have to upload their preprint or postprint, it's just not going to work. Two last things. Frustration is a really great source of motivation. You should try it. And really last thing, the digital preservation problem is real. And I'm happy to say that with Lee Dirks in the room. And the reason I mention it is that I was able to open PowerPoint presentations that went exactly 10 years back. All the ones before that are gone and can no longer be opened by Microsoft PowerPoint. Thank you very much.